Thank you very much, Pierre. And thanks to the organisers for inviting me. I was very pleased to be invited. So I thought hard about how I could do what the organisers asked our speakers to do. And they said, you know, present a central idea from your work, not a survey. So I thought hard about how to do that in 20 minutes. And I decided to do a risky thing, which is to present the central idea without evidence, possibly without argument. Now, it's not that I regard these things as unimportant. I regard them as crucial, and I can be even a little bit nerdy about evidence and standards of evidence. But it seemed to me the best use of my time would be to make my central idea conceivable to you, to try and explain exactly what it is that I am suggesting, and thereby to make it conceivable to you that this could be true. Okay. So the central idea is that cultural evolution shapes not only what we think, but how we think. So cultural evolution doesn't just shape the grist of our minds, what we believe, what we do, the things we make. It also shapes the mills of our minds, the cognitive processes which enable us to believe things, to do things, to make things. And something very like this, of course, has been claimed or has been presupposed by people in the humanities and parts of the social sciences, especially social anthropologists, for a very long time. What might be distinctive about my central idea are two things. First of all, that I take the way we think in a computational sense. So like most experimental psychologists, I consider that the mind can, it can be helpful in understanding the mind to see the mind as like a computer, as an information processor. And second, I'm not just saying that culture shapes the way we think, but that cultural evolution shapes the way we think, cognitive mechanisms, and I'm gunning for a pretty strong, a pretty strict sense of cultural evolution. So the term cultural evolution is used in a variety of ways. At the most general level, there's the historical sense of cultural evolution. So business people, politicians, we'll talk about some broadly cultural phenomenon evolving if they just mean it changes over time. A stronger, more interesting sense of cultural evolution is the populational sense. And that is the idea that large-scale changes in the distribution of cultural attributes within a population. It could be the distribution of the use of a certain technology or the eating of a certain food, that those large-scale changes are the aggregate consequences of many little episodes of social learning, of one agent learning from another. Okay. Now, the yet stricter sense of cultural evolution assumes not only that large-scale changes are the aggregate consequences of lots of little episodes of social learning, but also assumes that the conditions necessary for Darwinian selection are present in the cultural domain, that there are processes where cultural variants are generated and some of them get copied more than others in ways that result in cultural phenomena, practices, technology, and so on, getting better over time. An adaptation process, a Darwinian adaptation process, which is operating on cultural rather than genetic variants. Now, you will have heard of mimetics. Mimetics is a high-profile but relatively small section of the selectionist approach to cultural evolution. Very broadly speaking, most selectionists assume that cultural variants, practices, food preferences, either persist or go extinct by virtue of the effects they have on the lives of those who carry them or who practice them. But mimetics says, no, the cultural variants, the memes, are in it for themselves. So mimetics is a particular kind of selectionist approach to cultural evolution, which is an analog of selfish gene theory. It's selfish meme theory. Now, my central idea lies here within the selectionist approach, not within the mimetic approach. The way that I differ from most other selectionists, I differ in two ways. Names you may have heard of: Rob Boyd, Pete Richardson, Joe Henrich, in this country, Kevin Leyland, and an increasing number of selectionist cultural evolutionists are around. I'm in broad agreement with them, but I differ on two things. One is they tend to see genetic evolution and cultural evolution as very closely bound to one another. In contrast, I see cultural evolution as pretty autonomous with respect to genetic evolution. And second, they have a different explanatory target. On the whole, they do want to explain what I'm calling the grist, as it were, what we do and what we make. They want to explain in terms of selection processes operating on cultural variants. Instead, my explanatory target is the way we think, cognitive mechanisms, the mills rather than the grist. So what are these cognitive mechanisms to be explained by cultural evolution? What are the distinctively human cognitive mechanisms? Now, for many people, there's just one, and that's language. Language is a kind of a magic module that makes our lives so different from those from all other animals. But there are many other candidates for distinctively human cognitive processes: metacognition, causal understanding, cognitive or mental mapping, mental time travel, theory of mind, imitation, teaching, normative reasoning, social learning biases. Each of these has been proposed, as it were, as the central thing that makes our lives so different from those of other animals. I'm pretty Catholic in this respect. I think these are all distinctively human cognitive mechanisms. That is, they are present in mature adult humans. They are domain specific. They are absent or present only in a nascent form in other animals. And I would argue that cultural evolution plays a dominant role in the development of all of them. So, whereas traditional evolutionary psychologists allow that we have lots of modules which make us different from other animals, they, to use Steven Pinker's term, see each of these modules as a cognitive instinct. It's kind of programmed in the genes for us to develop these. I agree with them that we have these modules, you might say, but I think they're cognitive gadgets rather than cognitive instincts. So I think they're a bit like kayaks and traps and crossbows, for example. Now, take a kayak. Kayaks are not products of genetic evolution. I think that's uncontroversial. Probably they're not products of invention either. Insofar as contemporary kayaks have good design, it's probably not because individuals sat down and worked out how best to build a kayak so that it would float and move fast through the water and so on. So not genetic evolution, not invention. Rather, to the extent that they fit their environments, kayaks do so because there have been in the past lots of less successful kayaks. So kayaks have been generated. Those that didn't sink were around to be copied when new kayaks were being made. So over generations of kayaks, kayak construction got better. But not because smart minds saw the best way to build them, and not because of genetic evolution, instead because of cultural evolution. So I'm suggesting something similar for these distinctively human cognitive processes. So let's take, for example, a cognitive process which is specialized for the interpretation and prediction of behaviour. Now, we typically call such a module a theory of mind. I'll use that term without too much commitment to its theoretical nature or anything like that. So the suggestion here is that we acquire our theory of mind in the course of development, largely through social interaction with other individuals and through what they tell us about the mind. So my theory of mind has been constructed in the course of my development through social interaction with others, largely in the case of theory of mind, linguistic social interaction. But different groups of people at different times in history have generated different theories of mind, different specialized mechanisms for interpreting and predicting behavior. The ones that remain in the world today are the ones that were successful in the sense that the groups who used those theories of mind had lots of babies, attracted lots of immigrants, were emulated by lots of other groups, in part by virtue of the theory of mind that they held, and consequently those groups budded more, they, as it were, reproduced, they produced more groups than the ones with the now extinct theories of mind. Okay. So that's the suggestion, that's the central idea. Now you might think, so what is in the genes? You know, this woman is saying we don't have genetic programs for the development of these big special cognitive mechanisms. Things like theory of mind, a capacity to imitate, causal understanding. I'm denying that we have genetic programs for the development of those things. So am I saying that the mind of a newborn baby is just like the mind of a newborn chimpanzee? Am I, in that sense, a blank slater? No. Okay. I don't know whether there are or have ever been any people who really believe in a blank slate, but even if there are, I'm not one of them. I do think the mind of a newborn baby is very different from that of a chimpanzee. I think genetic evolution has tweaked the human mind in small but very important ways. Specifically, I think our genetic starter kit, and this is a term which I think I've stolen from Uta Frith, but it's such a lovely term. Our genetic starter kit, I think, has temperamental, attentional, and cognitive, central processing components. So I think compared with, this is my reading of the principally primate literature, the comparative literature, and the developmental literature suggests to me we are unlike chimpanzees in that we are much more socially tolerant and socially motivated. That we are unlike our ancestors in that we are born with a bias to attend to faces and to voices, and that we have immensely powerful central cognitive processes of learning, memory, and control. So these temperamental changes get us up close and personal from an early age with a wide range of adults. We have the opportunity to observe them, to listen to them, because they are tolerant of our presence as juveniles. And they also enable adult humans to have the patience to teach. That's what the tolerance and the motivation gives us. The attentional biases, I think, mean that the attention of a newborn baby is locked on to that, to other agents, from birth, ready to take in not just care, but also information from people. And third, we have souped up mechanisms of learning, memory, and control, which are able to process the torrent of information which is coming in from the very beginning by virtue of these tweaks. And it can not only capture that information, give us facts about the world, but it can also, these central cognitive processes, although they are themselves domain and taxon general, I think they, through social interaction, can build these new distinctively human domain-specific cognitive processes. Now, how could they do that? I want to spend the remaining time giving you an example to give you an idea of how domain general cognitive processes could, through social interaction, build a new domain-specific cognitive process. And the example is imitation. So the term imitation is used in the cognitive science literature to refer to a very specific kind of social learning. Social learning in which the individual copies the topography of another agent's body movements. They copy the way in which the other agent's body parts move relative to one another. So this little boy is imitating the men, not by virtue of the fact that he's going in the same direction, but because parts of his body, his arms, are in the same configuration relative to one another and to the trunk, as are the body parts of the men. And you might think, well, that's an arcane category of social learning, but it's thought to be hugely important in having got human cultural inheritance off the ground, that we need to be able to do this topographic matching of behavior in order to learn how to make and to use tools, and in order to acquire the gestures and mannerisms and ritualistic body movements that promote social bonding, that distinguish in-groups from out-groups, and thereby that provide a basis for cooperation. So imitation is thought to be very important functionally, but it's also proved to be a bit of a puzzle for psychologists to work out how the cognitive system could be doing this. Because if you think about the little boy, as he performs the imitative action, what performing that action shows him is entirely different from what he sees when he looks at the models that he's copying. So when he performs the action, all he sees is the path in front of him. He doesn't see anything remotely like what he sees when he looks up at one of the men. So how does his cognitive system map what he's seen there onto the feel of what he's doing here? The correspondence problem. Now, a few years ago, my colleagues and I came up with a potential solution to the correspondence problem, which addresses this question of how domain general processes, and specifically associative learning, could, through social interaction, build a new domain-specific cognitive mechanism, one which will allow topographic matching. And what our solution to the correspondence problem says is that this topographic matching is done by a very large number of these. We call these matching vertical associations. So we have a very lean, image-like sensory representation of an action, connected by a bidirectional associative link to a motor representation of the same action. These are not inborn, according to our theory, but they begin to be learned. The repertoire of these vertical associations begins to accumulate very early in life when, for example, a baby watches herself moving her hand. So to perform the hand movement, there's activation of the motor representation of, say, grasping. That's activated in order to make the action happen. If the baby is watching herself while she does it, there is correlated activation of the sensory visual representation of the same action, and that correlated activation of the sensory and motor representations is, according to associative learning theory, necessary and sufficient for the establishment of an excitatory link between those two representations. But self-observation is perhaps the simplest but not the most important source of the experience giving us these vertical associations. Most of that experience is deeply sociocultural. So, for example, when I am imitated as an infant by an adult, I'm getting this correlated activation of the motor and sensory representations for every fractional action that I'm producing. When I move while looking in a mirror, a cultural artifact, I'm getting the same kind of experience, correlated sensory motor experience. When I engage in synchronous drills or dance routines to a musical beat, again, I'm getting the correlated sensory motor experience, which will expand my repertoire of these matching vertical associations. And once I've got a good-sized repertoire of these, then I'm going to be able to engage in motor learning, the kind of learning that we normally only engage in by practice, when, for example, learning to ride a bike. I'm going to be able to engage in that motor learning without doing anything myself, just by watching somebody else act. So imagine that these are three vertical associations for the components of curtsying, and say you can't curtsy. As you look at me doing it, you engage in some perceptual sequence learning, so you're coding the components, the sequential components of this action. That would enable you to recognize it if you saw it again. That alone wouldn't enable you to do it. But if you have a matching vertical association for each component, then you're going to be able to engage in motor sequence learning while you're sitting there passively watching, because you're going to get successive activation of the corresponding motor representations. So you can learn a new action sequence by observation, provided that you've got the vertical associations and you get the vertical associations through sociocultural experience and an associative learning mechanism. Just to put that another way, these matching vertical associations are gearing together two pre-existing domain-general cognitive processes. It's gearing up perceptual learning with motor learning. So we have, with this gear in place, we have a whole new cognitive process, an imitation mechanism, which has been produced by associative learning using input from social interaction. So, I'm suggesting that distinctively human cognitive mechanisms, insofar as they do their jobs well, it is because of cultural evolution rather than genetic evolution. And that has a number of implications. For example, it suggests that learning to read, literacy acquisition, is a better paradigmatic example of cognitive development of distinctively human mechanisms than is language. It also suggests that cognitive mechanisms can be adaptive in a strong sense without being in our genes. This is an evolutionary approach to cognitive mechanisms, which is not nativist. Those two things are being pulled apart. And third, and more broadly, it suggests that our minds are more fragile, but also more agile than the traditional evolutionary psychological view suggests. So more fragile in that wars or epidemics could make a society not merely lose know-how, but lose the means to acquire know-how, lose mechanisms of cultural learning. More fragile. But on the other hand, it suggests that we are not stuck in the Pleistocene past with Stone Age minds. Cultural evolution moves much faster than genetic evolution. So it suggests that our minds are actually rather well attuned or adaptive to the worlds in which we actually live, and arguably poised to make the changes necessary to get them tuned to worlds in which social media and virtual reality and robotics are the new normal. Thank you.